It's nice to see you.
Hi.
How do you do me? Sure am glad you came out tonight. It's nice to see you.
Hi.
How do you do me? I love that walking. I love that talking. I love that sparkle in your eye.
Hello and welcome to Texas Cannabis Report, your eyes and ears for cannabis news from across the Lone Star State. I'm your host, Stephen Carter, and this is episode 9 of the show. Tonight we're going to be featuring some election results, including marijuana's big win at the polls recently, a story about former All-Pro running back Ricky Williams, who is no longer toking up, a foster parent sentenced to life after killing a child who was taken from her parents because of their marijuana consumption, some upcoming events, a recap from the Dallas Marijuana March with an interview from their executive director, Sean McAllister. We've got music guests, the Black 13, and more news from around the Lone Star State. Today is Wednesday, November 12th, 2014. You can find us at our website at txcann.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, and Instagram. You can also email us at texcan@gmail.com. We're also now on the 420 Radio Network. You can find that at 420radio.org. You can also find our shows on YouTube now as well. All right, getting into the first story of the night, we've got the 2014 election roundup, and marijuana won just about everywhere. I don't know if this came as a surprise to many people, but it was nearly a sweep. Marijuana legislation received a majority vote in nearly every election it was featured in, and now, of course, we have two new fully legal states, plus the nation's capital, and medical marijuana in a U.S. territory. Several other measures decided on decriminalization and how to regulate marijuana were voted on as well. Of course, in Washington, D.C., residents voted 69% in support of legalization, so now it's legal here in the nation's capital. Oregon's results for statewide legalization came out first with 54% in support. Alaska soon followed Tuesday night, showing 52% in support of legalizing cannabis. So this brings the total numbers of legal states to 4. Medical marijuana also passed in Guam with 56% of the vote. For those of you who aren't familiar with Guam, it's a U.S. territory out in the Pacific Ocean over there in the Asian Rim. A majority of supporters, 57%, voted in favor of medical marijuana in Florida. However, since it was a constitutional amendment and a ballot initiative, 60% of the vote was required in order for it to pass. The number was somewhere between 57 and 58%, so it didn't lose by much, and it definitely had a majority there. An initiative to decrease the penalty for marijuana, along with other drugs in California, passed with a 58% of the vote there, and it defelonized other drugs as well. Voters in Blythe rejected a tax. In Santa Ana, they prohibited dispensary bans. And in Shasta County, they repealed medical grow restrictions. While marijuana was already legal in Colorado, votes took place on a variety of cannabis-related issues there as well. The towns of Red Cliff and Manitou Springs rejected bans on marijuana shops. All other cities voting on bans accepted them, including the Denver suburb of Lakewood. The towns of Ramah and Hot Sulphur Springs rejected cannabis taxes, and all other cities voting on taxes approved them. Also, the towns of Palisade and Pinoia voted to both ban marijuana shops and tax them. So, for those keeping up here, they've banned marijuana shops from operating there in city limits, but they've also placed a tax on them should they be able to operate there as well. So, maybe they're anticipating a court challenge that allows them to set up shop. Several cities in Michigan voted on decriminalization measures. Up until the last night, election night, every city that had voted on such measure had passed it. Clare, Frankfort, Harrison, Lapeer, and Onaway became the first to reject such an amendment, with Lapeer's rejection decided by 6 votes. Those cities all had less than 2,000 total votes, while the 6 larger cities of Berkeley, Huntington Woods, Mount Pleasant, Pleasant Ridge, Port Huron, and Saginaw all came out in support. The two largest counties in New Mexico voted overwhelmingly to decriminalize marijuana, with Bernalillo, which is Albuquerque, voting 59.5% and Santa Fe voting a whopping 73.1% in favor. In Maine, South Portland joined neighboring Portland's legalization vote from a year ago, approving the legalization of 2.5 ounces by 52.4% vote. But smaller Lewiston rejected legalization with only 45.1% in support. Eight districts in Massachusetts voted on a non-binding public policy question that asked whether their state rep should vote to support tax and regulate policies for marijuana like alcohol. The results range from a low of 69% to a high of 74%. Six Massachusetts House districts went further by polling support for tax and regulate policies for marijuana like common fruits, vegetables, and herbs. Support ranged from a low of 54% to a high of 63%. That's basically a perfect 14-0 in a midterm election where many of those voters were asked to treat marijuana like tomatoes. Large contributor to this report was Russ Belville of 420 Radio, and of course some people there at National, Normal, and High Times as well. So much thanks to everyone who helped cover the election this year. It was a major success, and we want to thank everyone who turned out. Moving to more local news here in Texas, there was a battle over marijuana policy essential in the district attorney race down in Houston, and the incumbent Devin Anderson held off challenger Kim Ogg. After months of back and forth in an election centered around changing how the judicial system in Harris County would treat those caught with marijuana, incumbent Devin Anderson, who is a Republican, held off Ogg after basically a slip there at the end of the election, which kind of tilted the election in her favor. Anderson came out on top with 53% of the vote to Ogg's 47%. Anderson has been serving as district attorney since she was appointed by Governor Rick Perry to fill the office after her husband, Mike Anderson, died after a brief battle with cancer. In August, a plan was proposed by Ogg which would keep people out of jail for possessing small amounts of marijuana and instead give them community service and a clean record. She stated that it would save the county millions of dollars and allow police officers to stay out on patrol rather than spend time taking people to jail for marijuana. About a month later, Anderson countered with her own plan. However, it only covered first-time offenders, and each agency had the option of opting into her plan. Critics, even from her own party, complained that someone arrested on one side of the street could be cited and released with no jail time, while anyone arrested on the other side would be taken to jail and subjected to the full force of the judicial system. The Houston Chronicle reported that one possible reason why Ogg lost in the close race is because even though she had been praised by political pundits for running a solid campaign for more than a year, until the last week before the election, she committed her biggest gaffe. Ogg criticized the incumbent for a plea bargain that reduced the prison term of a woman later implicated in the death of a Harris County deputy. After accepting a plea deal for 3 years behind bars and serving 10 months, Kelly Jo Ivey was charged the previous week with drug possession in connection with a wreck that killed a Harris County deputy. Ogg's criticism that the plea deal somehow caused the officer's death led to the only law enforcement agency that endorsed her, officers of the Houston Metro Fraternal Order of Police, to rescind their support. And also, out in El Paso, Beto O'Rourke, who was endorsed by the National Normal PAC and has been a strong supporter of marijuana, and even ran his initial campaign in 2012 on marijuana legalization, or at least changing marijuana laws, he won re-election as well. Moving on, right before the election was Halloween, and of course a lot of people were being fed fears by the police department and the media, and people in general were worried that somehow kids would end up with marijuana-laced candy in their bags. And a lot of people wondered how that would be possible, since marijuana candy costs so much to produce. Why would someone just give it away to a child? And actually come to find out, those thoughts were very unfounded, as Halloween has now come and gone, and there were no reports of anyone finding marijuana-laced candy in their children's bags. All right, moving on to Ricky Williams' story. He says that he's done with weed now that his NFL pain is gone. The former University of Texas and Miami Dolphins running back Ricky Williams is renowned for his consumption of marijuana. However, he says that he now no longer needs it since his football days are over. Speaking recently with USA Today in an interview for a piece about the NFL's marijuana testing policies, Williams went into great detail about his thoughts on the matter. The league announced last month that the permitted threshold would be increased from 15 nanograms of carboxy THC per milliliter of urine to 35 nanograms. While that is a parts per billion, and in the grand scheme of things a very small amount, Williams stated that this would have kept him out of trouble with the league. He says, quote, "If that was the threshold when I was in the NFL, I would have never been in the drug program," he says. Compare that to Major League Baseball, which has a threshold of 50 nanograms, and the World Anti-Doping Agency, which does Olympic testing, uses a threshold of 150. NFL players are tested once a year for marijuana, opiates, amphetamines, and other illegal drugs between April 20th and August 9th. Pass the test, and the player is good until next year. But those who test positive must enter the intervention programs in which they can be tested more frequently and where more positive tests trigger escalating penalties. Each player submits two samples, an A sample and a B. Williams said, quote, "My A bottle was like 15.4 and my B bottle was like 14.6, something where I was right on the line. When I did a little bit of research, I found out how low that threshold was." Williams thinks NFL insists on a strict standard so that some players are caught, which offers the appearance of vigilant enforcement, even though he says players who pass the test in late April through early August have what amounts to a free pass to use throughout the NFL season. He says, "I think if you ask the NFL, they'd say the drug program is for our safety. However, but I think it's more to protect the image of the league." Williams says cannabis provided him pain relief, stress relief, and quicker healing times. He said, "It's easier on your liver. It doesn't cut your awareness off from your body the way most pain medications do. It actually increases awareness of your body. So, for instance, when I played and I smoked, my body would relax and I'd go into the room and stretch a little bit and do some yoga. And relaxing would help my body recover faster." It's interesting that people talk about physical benefits. I think there are some psychological benefits too, especially something like the NFL where the stress level is so high. It helps you relax, and everyone knows if your muscles relax, the blood is going to flow, which means more blood, more oxygen, more nutrients, which decreases healing time. Williams says he regrets his reputation as a stoner, but has no regrets about self-medicating with marijuana. He says, "It worked for me. It was better for my body. It wasn't necessarily better for my career. Since football is over for him now, and there is no more pain and stress to endure, he no longer consumes cannabis." He says, "When I go places, people offer me pot all the time. And then I have to say, well, I'm sorry, I don't do that anymore. And they look so disappointed." So there you have it. A true case of medical use, and then after he no longer needed it, he no longer consumed it. All right, we're following up on a story that we broke last year about a young girl who was taken from her parents after they admitted to CPS that they had smoked marijuana. Young Alex Hill was taken from her parents and then put in foster care, and then she was later killed while in foster care. A Milam County jury has found Sheryl Small guilty of capital murder for the death of her 2-year-old foster daughter in 2013. That was Alexandria Hill that we were talking about. Small, 55, was immediately sentenced to life in prison without parole, and in closing statements, the judge charged the jury of finding a verdict on 3 possible charges: capital murder, criminally negligent homicide, and serious injury to a child. Assistant District Attorney John Reddington told jurors that Small didn't want to be a foster mom and that it was her sister-in-law's idea. He says, quote, "She was not doing this for the right reasons. I think that Sheryl Small murdered Alex Hill. Once you look at all the evidence and you listen to your oath as jurors, this case deserves a guilty verdict for capital murder." Her defense lawyer argued on the other side that they did not bring enough evidence to prove that his client caused Alex's injuries purposefully. Early last year, the girl's father, Joshua Hill of Round Rock, spoke with local news about the incident. He said, quote, "We got to sit down at McDonald's and have lunch and play for a while. She got a little Despicable Me 2 toy in her Happy Meal and she loved it. She kept climbing up in my lap and she fed me french fries. That was the last time he would get to see his daughter, though, before he would visit her at the hospital, arriving to find she was in a coma. Alex was rushed to Rockdale Hospital with severe head injuries, then flown to Scott and White Children's Emergency Hospital in Temple and immediately placed on life support. She had been living with a foster parent since November 2012. Hill stated, "We never hurt our daughter, she was never sick, she was never in the hospital, and she never had any issues until she went to state care." For the first 2 months, Alex was placed in a home that Hill says was dangerous, as he claimed that she would come to visitation with bruises on her and mold and mildew in her back. "It got to a point where I actually told CPS that they would have to arrest me because I wouldn't let her go back." He said the situation seemed to get better, though, when she was placed with Shrill Small in Rockdale. Then Hill was called and told to come to the hospital. Alex was kept on life support, and for 2 days they hoped she would regain consciousness, but she ended up dying. Rockdale detectives say Small's explanation didn't match Alex's injuries, and she was arrested on murder charges. Another child was removed from her after Alex was taken to the hospital. Hill says that he was less than 4 months away from getting Alex back, and now he'll never get the chance. Alright, moving along to the upcoming events. We've got the Culture High screening by El Paso Normal on the 13th. Sugarland Regional Normal Meeting by Houston Normal on the 14th. Northeast Texas Normal is having their Thanksgiving potluck dinner in Longview on the 15th. Houston Normal is having a mixer with Catherine Neal on the 15th. Republicans Against Marijuana Prohibition and Young Americans for Liberty present Ask the Doctors About Medical Marijuana in Houston is on the 19th. Action for Alex is on the 20th. San Antonio will have their normal meeting on the 20th as well. And then on the 24th, the Culture High will be premiered by DFW Normal in Dallas. If you have a marijuana-related event going on in Texas, please email that to us at texcan@gmail.com, and we will get that up on our event page. You can find our event page on our website at txcann.com on our front page. All right, well, we've got coming up next is an interview from DFW Normal Executive Director Sean McAllister right after the Dallas Marijuana March concluded, and we'll go ahead and go to that right now. All right, I'm here at the Dallas Marijuana March with Sean McAllister. He's the executive director of DFW Normal. We just concluded the march. Sean, what did you think about this march compared to the one in May?
Well, I'm glad that we had about a similar showing to the Fort Worth March in May. We had about between 2,000 and 2,500 people here is kind of the police estimate. I'm very pleased that the city of Dallas was willing to work with us on this, issue us all manner of permits, which we have never filed for before. And I'm particularly impressed with the way that the Dallas Police Department handled their involvement with us. They were extremely respectful and courteous. They communicated very well with us, and we basically always knew what to expect from them. And because of that, I think that this may have been our most successful event ever. Not necessarily because it was the biggest or not the biggest, but because this was the most organized. This was the best showing that we've ever had as a legitimate organization in working with the civil government.
And you said that it started on time and ended on time?
We actually started a normal event on time and concluded on time. It's a miracle. It is a weed day miracle here at the Dallas Marijuana March.
Now, we were talking with the police earlier, and they said that whenever they work an event, usually they see a lot of fights, but they didn't see any fights here. What do you think about that being a normal thing?
Well, I think that it's crazy that police are used to going and policing a whole bunch of drunk people, and that's okay, but the idea of these same group of people changing their substance and thus changing their behavior, making them less violent, more orderly, more willing to respect the law, unlike drunk people. I think that it's crazy that cops are forced to work this normalcy of alcoholism in the world instead of giving them a much more calm and collected crowd to work with if they were medicating with cannabis.
Now, earlier you were talking about the coverage that the news gave us last night. You said that they said they weren't able to come out because they had Ebola stuff to cover. What did you think about that?
Well, when we had, to be clear, this was one reporter from one news station that told us not to expect a whole lot of coverage because of what was happening with Ebola and because we weren't expecting 10,000 people. Those were basically the two reasons that I was given by this one reporter that, out of professional courtesy, I will never name. I won't even name the station. But what it did was it pissed me off enough to write a little something about it, to inform all of these fine people who were planning to come to our event, and it pissed them off too. And so what happened was, the way that it should be, the marijuana community made the phones ring. They called the media, they tweeted, they did all of these things that they should already be doing all the time, and they did it really well. And the media heard them. They picked up the story. CBS did a wonderful story on Alexis and Dean Bortel. This was by far some of the best coverage marijuana has ever received on television in the state of Texas, in my opinion, because they took it seriously. They didn't try to make a joke about it. There wasn't a single pot pun to be found in the entire two-minute segment. It was emotional. It told a factual, real story about a real Texas family, and I think it touched a lot of Texans last night and this morning when it aired, and I think that because of that little bit of coverage, all of a sudden the media realized that there was a story here, and now I do believe we're going to hopefully see some, not maybe today coverage, but some kind of coverage at some point in the week from various media outlets acknowledging that this happened. Because, I mean, let's face it, we had 2,000 people on Dealey Plaza, where JFK was assassinated, talking about changing the laws of regarding marijuana in the state of Texas. That's never happened before. Certainly that's got to be newsworthy. Throw in the fact that most of these people were illegally consuming cannabis in a public place with cops all around, and nobody was arrested for it. If this can happen today at the Dallas Marijuana March or at the Global Marijuana March in Fort Worth or anywhere else for a day, why can't we just change the laws for all days and just make this a safer place for all of us and give the police real priorities, let them focus on some real crime.
Now, you said today was a very successful day for DFW Normal, so where does it go from here?
Well, I would like to get a count on our memberships. I think that we were just under 1,000 when this day started. We were right around 905, 910. Hopefully we cleared our 1,000th member today. That is an important hurdle for our organization to be able to say we represent 1,000 Texans. And then from there, we will just continue to try to change the... Oh, excuse us. We'll continue to try to change the laws. We'll continue to work with our representatives, go down to Austin, you know, testify, meet with these representatives and take our constituents, our cannabis community, to go and meet their representatives and let them know about this march that we had. Let them know that the police were cool, that the city was cool, and if this is happening, we should just go ahead and change our marijuana policy. And I think that because of this event, we're going to have a whole lot of ammunition to have conversations with our friends, our family, our teachers, our bosses, our coworkers, anybody will be able to say, hey, did you hear about thousands of people marching through the streets of Dallas for marijuana this weekend?
All right, well, thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Man, we love the Texas Cannabis Report. Thanks for making the trip out here. And herb's the word, everybody. Please, please support the cannabis candidates that want to see you paying taxes or at least not thrown in a cage when you choose to medicate with cannabis over a prescription drug. We can change the laws. Let's do it together. Herb's the word.
Hey, we love covering one of the most effective organizations in Texas. Thank you.
And that was Sean McAllister with DFW Normal. Texas Cannabis Report was there on hand to cover the entire event and spoke with several people there, including some of the officers working security for the event and a couple firefighters. We wrote a brief write-up on the event, which can be found in our show notes and on our website. I'd like to share a little bit of that with you now. With a little notice and hardly any advertising, the nonprofit group DFW Normal drew thousands of people to the marijuana protest march in Dallas on Saturday, the last Saturday of October. According to official police estimates, around 2,000 people were in attendance, featuring a lineup of speakers including political candidates, activists, lawyers, and a 9-year-old girl who suffers from seizures, along with several bands. The Dallas-Fort Worth chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws saw it all as a huge accomplishment. In fact, nearly as many people attended this march as there were at the Global Marijuana March event held this past May in downtown Fort Worth. This is also the largest group of people ever for a marijuana event at Dallas City Hall. Unable to secure a billboard on such short notice, with Clear Channel telling the group that they refused to do business with them, being able to draw such a crowd through social media and word of mouth was no small feat. In all, though, the organization spent about $1,500 getting permits for the event and complying with all the necessary requirements for hosting such a large amount of people, including portable toilets and security. At least a dozen Dallas police officers were on hand to ensure the event remained safe. Several of those officers voiced their support for marijuana legalization, though said that they wanted participants to be respectful by not consuming cannabis in front of them. At one point, an officer approached a man and pulled a joint from his hand, then calmly walked away without further incident. One officer noted that at times people pushed the limit, but no one ever stepped over the line. He says, quote, "Marijuana is still illegal, and people need to be aware of their surroundings. Go down the street, or at least away from officers and any children." That officer was happy, though, to see so many young people at the march. He said, quote, "Kids these days aren't hardly involved in politics at all, so it's refreshing to see them stand up for something they believe in, and hopefully that leads them to further activism in other areas down the road." Also on the scene were local firefighters. One of them stated that they support marijuana legalization, but asked that they not be photographed. Officers also asked to not be photographed as well. People of all ages and backgrounds were in attendance, from young children all the way up to the elderly, though those between 18 and 35 were the most prevalent. An elderly black man who happened to be across the street at the library took notice of the group and decided to join in. He had not heard about the event or DFW Normal, but was excited to see everyone coming together to defend people's rights. The event began slowly, with around 400 to start. However, the number swelled when the 2.5-mile march to Daley Plaza began. Daley Plaza is historically known as the place where President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Protesters filled the streets as police cleared the way. Most bystanders took great interest in the group, along with a few sour faces. Those marching chanted pro-marijuana slogans all the way as people honked and cheered in support. More speakers testified at the plaza almost as if it were a religious experience. Some of those speakers even openly smoked marijuana as they talked to the crowd. As DFW Normal Executive Director Sean McAllister spoke to the crowd, he stressed one point, that if people didn't go out to vote and contact their representatives, then the march was for nothing. You can find the rest of our coverage at our website. Alright, moving back over to Houston, a recently released poll shows that Texans in the Houston area largely are in support of marijuana decriminalization. Performed by KHOU Houston Public Media, the poll showed 62% in favor of decriminalizing marijuana, with 29% opposed and 8% undecided. The question asked respondents if they favored decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana for personal use, with no prison time and no criminal record. On the subject of legalizing the non-toxic plant, however, 49% of respondents said that they oppose legalization, while 43% are in support. Another 8% were undecided. Polls have recently shown support for legalization in both Texas and nationally at 58%. No questions were asked about medical marijuana, which enjoys over 70% support nationally and in Texas. Right, moving on over to Abilene, a woman who was found driving 5 miles per hour on the interstate was later found pulled over asleep at the wheel, and police took her to the hospital and drove her vehicle to the hospital for her, and that's whenever they discovered 160 pounds of marijuana and some bags in the back of the vehicle. She recently pleaded guilty to that. She will receive, well, she hasn't been sentenced yet, but she faces a maximum penalty of 20 years in federal prison and a $1 million fine. This all happened on Christmas Day of 2013. According to documents filed in the case, on December 25, 2013, the Abilene Police Department received multiple calls regarding a small sport utility vehicle that was on Interstate 20 traveling east at approximately 5 miles per hour. Officers found the vehicle parked on the shoulder of the highway with the woman asleep at the wheel. Moving over to Montgomery County, a Texas woman is suing a reality TV show after her home was raided for marijuana. A reality show called Texas Takedown has been sued for infringement of privacy rights after they illegally documented a raid on a Montgomery County woman's home for marijuana. The show was meant to be similar in format to Cops, but focused entirely on the home invasion aspect and the spectacle of drug raids. A raid which took place in 2011 now has them in hot water. In September of 2011, their cameras rolled as police busted down the door of 59-year-old Perla Carr. Once inside, officers arrested the woman and her son, Zachary May, and confiscated 60 cannabis plants. Despite what was found, eventually the charges against Carr were dropped due to lack of evidence. Now Carr is suing the TV show for violating her rights. She claims that the affidavit used to search her house was based only on testimonial that people smelled cannabis coming from the house. She is also claiming that having the film crew involved was a violation of her rights, citing the Fourth Amendment and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Wilson v. Lane, which states that it is a violation of the Fourth Amendment for police to bring members of the media or other third parties into a home during the execution of a warrant when the presence of the third parties in the home was not in aid of the execution of the warrant. The judge has allowed the lawsuit to proceed, saying that police failed to obtain her consent and had the proper release form signed. Carr says officers entered her home around 10:15 p.m. and woke her up. As Carr emerged from her bedroom, she says officers pointed at least one gun with laser sights at her chest. The group, which Carr said had no search warrant or arrest warrant, included Montgomery County Precinct 4 Constable Kenneth Hayden, Chief Barry Welch of the Constable's Office, three Constable's deputies, and a reporter who worked for several newspapers. Carr's suit also named Montgomery County District Attorney Brett Ligone and First Assistant District Attorney Phil Grant as defendants. Although the two were not in the group that came to Carr's house, her suit claims they advised Hayden by telephone to force entry. In March, the defendants filed a motion to dismiss Carr's complaint on the basis of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Carr maintained in her complaint that prior to the officer's arrival, no marijuana or anything else illegal was visible from outside the home she shared with her son, Zachary May, nor was there a suspicion that anyone was in danger inside the house. All right, moving on to our music segment. The song is called Bastard, and it is by the Black 13.
Someone
That was the Black 13 and their song entitled Bastard. Alright, a recently released study claims that there are brain abnormalities in heavy marijuana consumers. The paper says that the effects of chronic marijuana use on the brain may depend on the age of first use and duration of use, according to researchers at the Center for Brain Health at the University of Texas at Dallas. In a paper recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers for the first time comprehensively describe existing abnormalities in brain function and structure of the long-term marijuana users with multiple magnetic resonance imaging techniques. That would be an MRI. Findings show chronic marijuana users have smaller brain volume in the orbitofrontal cortex, a part of the brain commonly associated with addiction, but also increased brain connectivity. It says, quote, "We have seen a steady increase in the incidence of marijuana use since 2007, said Dr. Francesca Philby, director of the Cognitive Neuroscience Research and Addictive Disorders at the Center for Brain Health and associate professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas." He says, quote, "However, research on its long-term effects remains scarce despite the changes in legislation surrounding marijuana and the continuing conversation surrounding this relevant public health topic." The research team studied 48 adult marijuana users and 62 gender and age matched non-users, accounting for potential biases such as gender, age, and ethnicity. The authors also controlled for tobacco and alcohol use. On average, the marijuana users who participated in the study consumed the drug 3 times per day. Cognitive tests showed that chronic marijuana users had lower IQ compared to age and gender matched controls, but the differences do not seem to be related to the brain abnormalities, as no direct correlation can be drawn between IQ deficiency and OFC volume decrease. Further says that tests reveal that earlier onset of regular marijuana use induces greater structural and functional connectivity. Greatest increases in connectivity appear as an individual begins using marijuana. Findings show severity of use is directly correlated to greater connectivity, although increased structural wiring declines after 6 to 8 years of continued chronic use. Marijuana users continue to display more intense connectivity than healthy non-users, which may explain why chronic long-term users seem to be doing just fine despite smaller OFC brain volumes. To date, existing studies on long-term effects of marijuana on brain structures have been largely inconclusive due to limitations in methodology, said Dr. Philby. While our study does not conclusively address whether any or all of the brain changes are a direct consequence of marijuana use, these effects do suggest that these changes are related to age of onset and duration of use. The study offers a preliminary indication that gray matter in the OFC may be more vulnerable than white matter to the effects of delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, which is THC, the main psychoactive ingredient in the cannabis plant. According to the authors, the study provides evidence that chronic marijuana use initiates a complex process that allows neurons to adapt and compensate for smaller gray matter volume, but further studies are needed to determine whether these changes revert back to normal with discontinued marijuana use, whether similar effects are present in occasional marijuana users versus chronic users, and whether these effects are indeed a direct result of marijuana use or a predisposing factor. All right. Meet the lobbyists pushing marijuana law reform in Texas. With a minimum of 3 bills set to be filed in the 2015 Texas legislative session, activists are in need of someone with experience in lobbying to ensure the bills make it out of committee. Meet Randall Kuykendall, a former lobbyist for the Texas Municipal Police Association. Hired by the Marijuana Policy Project, he is no stranger to the inner workings of the Capitol. He will now be focusing on marijuana policy reform. MPP has been a driving force behind changing the laws in other states, both medically and full legalization. The Austin Post recently sat down with Kuykendall to talk with him about his new job. Asked about what his job looks like on a daily basis, he responded, "On a daily basis, it's educating and asking the questions of legislators, where do you stand? The biggest thing which has surprised me is that despite the fact that there have been lots of advocates and associations working in Texas to reform outdated and antiquated laws, legislators still aren't familiar with marijuana and its basic functions, the benefits, the harms, and the law regarding possession. There's a lot of education going on. Multiple groups have banded together in Texas to help change the law in the upcoming session. The 3 bills expected to be introduced are medical marijuana, penalty reductions, and full legalization." Kuykendall says that the strongest support is for medical cannabis. He says there is a lot of support for medical marijuana. Not necessarily the version we are drafting now, but we are working on it. There is more support for that every day. The civil penalties bill is the same. There have been movements here for a long time to reduce those penalties, and it's appealing across the board because it's not changing a lot for drug policy. Legislators see it as a smart economic move. You can get that full interview with Kuykendall at the Austin Post. You can find that on our website. All right, rounding out the show today, we have in our show notes a flyer that you could put up in your hometown for the Texas Cannabis Report, help spread the news about what's going on here in Texas, and help get everyone more informed so that the law can be changed for the better. You can find that in our show notes and on our website. Print out that flyer and put up at cannabis-friendly businesses and local bulletin boards. We definitely urge you to do that. All right, that's all we have for our show today. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
If I said I told you so, let it roll, let it roll, let it roll on down the road. If I said I told you so, let it roll, let it roll, let it roll on down the road. Yeah, I refuse to ever back down. I've been a part of the boss, I've been true till now. Can they cover up from under us? They fuck with us and beg for trust. This wonderlust was built for us, I mean all of us. Raise your head and raise your fist, put down your fucking Twitter pics. Use your mind, corrupt your tits and throw a brick the establishment. Yeah, follow me, let's make a change. I ain't trying to box it out there, I'm trying to box with your brain.
If I said I told you so, let it roll. When your honor is deceitful, when the music stops, all we've got is our voice at the top of your lungs. Make feel the noise, open your eyes to the lies brought to you by the government. Political puppets got a corporate hand in your ass, and you're loving it.
If I said I told you.